Lord, may you be present to us that we might hear your voice and follow you. In Jesus' name, amen. I wonder what makes Good Friday good for you. Is it the hot cross bun bonanza that we're all about to have for morning tea? Or maybe the chocolate overload that's coming on Sunday? Perhaps it's the supersized weekend that we get to enjoy. Perhaps the last dash down the coast before winter arrives. I think what makes Good Friday good is that it is a doorway to a new reality. A reality that is supposed to change our lives and even our world when we are ready to take the journey that it requires. C.S. Lewis had a go at describing this doorway. He presented it as a wardrobe in one of his books, filled with musty old coats, leading to a place that he called Narnia. At the centre of this place was a king called Aslan. And while Aslan was neither safe nor tame, Aslan was good in so many ways that were simply misunderstood by many. Now, of course, the danger of presenting the doorway to God's world in a children's book is that people mistake it as something that's just for kids. In truth, Narnia was the place where Peter and Susan, Lucy, and above everyone else, Edmund, got to discover who they were. And it was the space where they could become who they were always meant to be. Now, I'm the first to admit that picturing Good Friday as a doorway is hard, let alone to see it as the pathway into God's new world. But as we sit in this place, with music that might sound strange, costumes that look a little weird, rituals that might seem all too familiar, we have entered a wardrobe that leads not into a fantasy land, but into a space where we get to become the person we were always meant to be. Now, as doorways go, Good Friday does not look particularly inviting. It's filled with awful and terrible stuff. There are callow religious authorities who betray everything that they are supposed to stand for because someone has the temerity to tell them to listen, because they've got everything back to front. There's a greasy politician who washes his hands and plans to slither out by passing responsibility over to others. There are soldiers who take macabre pleasure in torturing someone with beatings and mockery. The landscape we see is bleak and wintry, with a death that we would just rather not look at. Jesus does not die the kind of neat, peaceful, comfortable death that we would like for ourselves, surrounded by candles, maybe having our loved ones holding our hands. Now, this is just the opposite. It is a bloody lynching. And it's everything that we fear. It's slow and tormenting. And if the violence isn't bad enough, there's psychological and emotional and spiritual abuse heaped onto. You're a failure, a con man, a useless pretender, is what everyone calls. After all, if Jesus couldn't save himself, what good is he to anybody else. And yet, if we look carefully, something else appears in this story. There's a lamppost in the middle of it. In the middle of all this suffering and torment, fear and pain. Blink and you'd miss it. Matthew says it simply. There were many women there, looking on from a distance. In his darkest hour, Jesus was never alone. Those who provided for him from the start never left his side. They looked on. And although they experienced great powerlessness and helplessness, they did the only thing they could do. They stayed. Not out of obligation, but out of love. Joseph of Arimathea, a student of Jesus, showed great love also. When everything was lost, Joseph showed his love by cleaning up the mess that everyone left behind. Ordinarily, crucified bodies would be left to rot, a sign of their worthlessness. But Joseph fronts up to the governor and asks, "Can I bury Jesus' body?" We really don't get the whole tomb thing. Tombs in the ancient world were a bit like cars are today. They were status symbols. Most folks today make do with a cheap, second-hand, run-around knockabout. But here we see Joseph giving Jesus his brand new Maserati. Not for a loan, but forever. He takes Jesus' body, clothes it in fresh linen, and places Jesus in a place that he had lovingly prepared for himself. And of course, those in power do what they always do. They want to be sure that what they have done cannot be undone. They post armed guards. They seal the stone and make it tamper-proof. They want what they have done to remain hidden and for everyone to move on, nothing to see. If I were God and I had just watched my child treated in that way, well, I would think I would just want to go all Dirty Harry on them. Just to burn the whole place down. Make everyone pay. But what makes Good Friday good is that God responds to this kind of violence not with furious retribution, but with generous restoration. To appreciate the goodness of this Friday, we need to see how sin and forgiveness fit together. Sadly, for most people, their vision of sin is little more than a small piece of Turkish delight. We see sin as something trivial, or worse, something as just criminal, something that others do, not me. This makes forgiveness seem little more than a simple exchange, like running a credit card through a machine, just beep, beep, beep. We say a few words, we go to church, and we're off the hook. Scot-free with the license to ignore everything that we've done because somehow we've just managed to get a ticket to heaven. But Jesus felt the full weight of sin. He was on the receiving end of other people's expediency and privilege, the betrayal and hatred, the beatings and the abuse, the isolation and humiliation, all the blame and gaslighting that we do. The powers did not simply deny Jesus' identity. They hated what it was. And when he wouldn't stop being himself, when he refused to be like them, the authorities had him killed. It wasn't that Jesus couldn't save himself. It's that he wouldn't save himself. Over and over, Jesus has every opportunity to run away. To save himself, all he had to do was to pretend to be something else, to be someone else. But he chooses not to. He chose to be himself. He chose not to save himself because he wanted to save us. Here's the thing. God knows how eagerly we are to sit with the authorities because we like to judge others by our standards of correctness. He knows full well how readily we avoid responsibility because we can't face the truth of what we do because we don't want to see what we look like. He knows that we love to yell insults with the crowd and bang the hammers and pretend that nothing is wrong. God's new world is a world not of judgment and condemnation or of violence. It's an offer for a new life. God sees what we do. And yet God believes that we can become something better. God sees the darkness, but yearns that we might become our true selves. Good Friday is good because all the violence and betrayal and abuse do not get to have the last word, either in Jesus' life or ours. Good Friday is good because love gets to have the last word, because only love is capable of opening up the grave so that everyone can find life and freedom. The writer to the letter of Hebrews shows us this new world, a place where forgiveness reigns, where wholeness and hopefulness and connection push out all of the brokenness, disappointment, and isolation, to create a place where we get to be ourselves at last. We might ask, how can this be? How can this happen? As the writer to the Hebrews explains, it is because Christ is our great high priest. Christ helps us to connect with God, with others and ourselves, not because he is the purest thing that has ever walked the earth. No, it's because Jesus endured the worst things that we can experience. And he was not overcome by it. This enables him to say to us, I know what it is like to go through this life, and I will stand by you always. And because Jesus stands with us, we can find a forgiveness that is so much bigger than we can imagine. This forgiveness will do three things in our lives. First, it reorientates our hearts, our minds, and our bodies. A new covenant I will make with them. I will put my laws into their hearts and write it onto my minds. This is not language of removal. It's about having a new purpose, a new direction in life. God is not out there, elusive and ephemeral. God is something in here that emerges from deep within. Our hearts and our minds are to be reoriented by love and not determined by the hurts or the wounds or the regret or the shame or the nastiness that flows within. It is to let God wash away all the names that we've been called, all the regrets that we carry, all the things that separate us from God, and to be open about our true selves. The second thing we are given is something to hold on to. We're not to hold on to the grudges and the resentments and the wounds we have, but we are to hold on to the God who holds us. God is faithful. And on Good Friday, Jesus was filled with pain and helplessness and disappointment. But he came out the other side. And this is the one who holds on to us. Finally, forgiveness directs us outward. The writer says, let us provoke one another to be people who spark and spur one another onto love and doing good and helpful things. People who put wrong things right. We are to be people who are constructive and positive, people who are oriented by love, anchored in love, and willing to receive love. Good Friday is not only good for you, it is good for us. Our nation faces a Good Friday moment right now, with the referendum for an Indigenous voice to Parliament. There are many who would have us believe that this is simply the worst thing possible, that it's worse than useless, that it won't save anyone, that we're better off keeping everything the way it is. But the voice calls us to listen, to love, to value the songs and the hopes of this land's first people. It calls us to turn away from the deafness and the blindness and the hardness and the brokenness of our past so that a new future might emerge. And as scary as that sounds, it's not something we do alone. Because Aboriginal people will hold our hands. And Christ will hold us all. A new future for our nation beckons, but it will only happen if we are prepared to spur one another onto good things, especially when bad things stand in our way. In a moment, we're going to share communion together. I know this is a little unusual for us on Good Friday, but it seemed good for us to do this together. You've been given a rock. I like to think of it as the original fidget spinner. But as you come to communion, I want you to imagine all the things that have gotten in the way of who you truly are. Not just the Turkish delights size stuff, but the really messy, awful, shitty stuff that gets in your life. The anger that you're ashamed by, the things that have humiliated you, the things that have scarred and wounded you. And imagine those things leaving your heart, moving through your fingers, and lodging in the stone. And when you come up to communion, don't try to kneel down here, but place the stone down upon the cloth and leave it there. Let all that resentment and anger and bitterness go, even just for a moment. And let the life of Christ fill you instead. Let the body and the blood of Christ bring new life into all those places so that goodness and kindness and hope and love might grow within. Because this is the wardrobe today. The light is here, and I hope and pray that you might embrace the love that holds you this day and forevermore.